Very well, time is 1:08 and call to order. I'm Lynn Herring. I would like to welcome you all to the Board of Directors meeting for the Student Success Program Nonprofit Board, which operates Audeo Charter Schools and the Charter Schools of San Diego. I am Lynn Herring, Chairman and Chairman of the Board, and I will facilitate this meeting. Let's take a roll call first. When I call your name, please provide the group a brief introduction. Do we have any visitors for introductions take place?
None that we're aware of.
Okay. So introductions not required. And Mary, are there any new members of the team?
Same team. Attendance?
Okay.
Hello, everybody.
All right. So
Benita's here. Have you met Benita? There's Benita. She's functioning as our financial administrator and doing a great job. Nelia helped us with the transition, and she and Vanita and Lynn are teaming, but Vanita has a responsibility for the finance department, and she's doing great.
Good. Welcome aboard. So roll call myself here, Scott. Scott, there you go. It's Tim.
Scott's on mute.
Present.
There we go. David.
Present. Welcome, Benita.
Say again.
I said present and welcome, Benita.
Oh. okay. And I saw Tim.
I'm here, present.
Okay, and we have Eric. Not here yet.
He was planning on joining us. He may be.
Yeah, no problem. Moving on to item 1.3, consideration of approval adoption for board findings pursuant to Government Code Section 54953 Echo 1. I think I'm going to record this so I don't have to keep reading it every time. The SSP Board of Directors determines in accordance with the Government Code Section 54953, Echo 1 Bravo, that meeting in person would present imminent risk to the health or safety of its members. Pursuant to Government Code Section 54953, Echo 3, the board has also reconsidered the circumstances of the state emergency declared by the governor on March 4th, 2020, and finds that the state of emergency continues to directly impact the ability of the directors to meet safely in person, and that the state or local officials continue to impose a recommended measures to promote social distancing. Additionally, AB 36361 requires that this finding be made every 30 days to continue to permit teleconference meetings without adhering to some of the traditional requirements of the Brown Act, specifically that teleconferencing requirements of Government Code Section 54953 Bravo 3. Do I have a motion for the approval of item 1.3?
Motion to approve.
Thank you. May I have a second?
Second, Morton.
Thank you. We'll now have a vote. Myself, aye. Scott?
Aye.
David?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
And is Eric present?
Not yet.
Absent. Establishment of a quorum. Do I have the motion to establish a quorum?
Motion to approve.
The second, please. Morton. Thank you. So we conduct a roll call for the establishment. Myself, aye. Scott?
Aye.
David?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
And Eric? Eric is absent. However, we still have sufficient attendance to establish a quorum. A quorum is hereby established. We'll now ask individuals to stand and the Pledge of Allegiance. pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America
and to the republic
for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Very good. Moving on to item 1.6, approval of the agenda. Item 1.6, do I have a motion to approve the item 1.6 with recommendations from Mary, if there are any?
Yes, you have a recommendation to approve, or motion to approve. Sorry.
Do you have any? Do you have anything that needs to be added to that, Mary?
No. No.
Okay. Then I have a motion to approve. May I have a second?
Second, Morton.
Very well. We will conduct a voting roll call. Myself, aye. Scott?
Aye.
David?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
And Eric? Still absent. No problem. Moving on. Public comment. Public comment for items of interest in the public within the scope of the Student Success Programs Board non-agenda shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Public comment for item agenda items will be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. Any person who wishes to make a comment on either non-agenda or agenda items shall use the raise hand feature on Zoom to notify the board accordingly. In accordance with the Brown Act, the discussion or action may occur at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to respond to give direction to the staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below. Each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, I may equivocally decrease the time for each speaker in order to make sure we stay within the time limits. Item 2.1 is a opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that are not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 2 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by myself. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on these items, on items not on the agenda?
None that we're aware of.
Okay. No. Hearing none, we'll move on. Item 2.2, this is the opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that appear on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by myself. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on the agenda items?
None that we've been made aware of.
Very well, and I don't see any raised hands. Moving on. 3.0 is the board workshop and training. Young, Mini, and Core law firm will provide training to the board regarding professional development training, including best practices in charter schools, board management, updates on the Charter School Act, and a review of the corporate practices, fiduciary duties, and financial oversight, the Brown Act, and conflict of interest laws. Okay. Anything we need to do from here is just to say stage is yours, Paul.
All right. Well, thank you, Board Chair. Thank you and welcome all. Thanks again for having us in part two of our presentation of those things that Admiral Herring just read out. My colleague Kayla Hayden is joining us, so we'll bounce back and forth and split up this workshop and try to keep it interesting and fast-paced and on time here. So let me just start in by sharing my screen. Let me know when that comes up, and then we should be on the PowerPoint.
You're good on this side.
All right. No recording here, so I'll set that up like that, and we're ready to go. Sorry. Well, you might recall last time we talked about best practices, we talked about fiduciary duties, we talked about governance versus management, and the Brown Act. Brown Act is one part of the state's transparency laws that apply to public agencies. Another part is conflict of interest laws. And the third part is the Public Records Act. We're not going to cover the Public Records Act here today, but we're going to focus first on conflict of interest laws. So there's about a half dozen conflict of interest laws in the state of California that apply to charter schools now through statute. And they all have this in common. They are attempting to address a situation where a conflict arises between the board members' fiduciary duties, their duty to operate in the best interest of the organization, and the board members' own personal interests, in most cases, personal financial interests. So in short, conflict of interest is a clash between the individual's duty to the office or to the corporation and his or her own personal interests. Common types of financial interests that are triggered by conflict of interest laws: ownership or investment in a business entity. So, you know, local businesses you might own, trades or services you might own, service companies that you might own or invested in. Investments in real property, straight up your own house, other property, rental property, sources of income, your job or any other source of income. Gifts. So people who give you gifts that talk about the gift threshold shortly, they are actually reportable financial interests. And then any other effects on personal finances that you might have by the actions and decisions of the organization. And conflicts on a financial basis also come into play with you and your immediate spouse, significant other, and dependents in the household. The first and the most draconian of the conflict of interest laws is Government Code 1090. This is the one that hung up, you might recall, in the 90s, our state superintendent of public instruction, Bill Honig. I'll give you an example there in a second. But if you are a public officer or official, and that is addressing board members and or administrators or employees, and you are making a contract typically done by the board or the higher level senior administrative team, and you have a financial interest in that contract, that triggers 1090. If it is a board member with that financial interest, the board cannot enter into that contract. Absolute flat prohibition. The only way to get around 1090, if you have a financial interest in a contract that's coming before your organization, is to resign from the board. We've had people do that. If it's an administrator, if it's the executive officers or administrators, there's a recusal process that you can have and you can follow, but you do need to disclose, abstain from involvement from the very inception. Now, I said it's draconian because it prohibits the entire board from entering into that contract, even if that contract's in the best interest of the organization and the best price, et cetera, unless that board member resigns. Making a public contract is broadly defined. And if you violate this statute, it's a criminal act. It's a felony. And it actually also leads to a reversal of the contract and disgorgement of any monies paid. So in this case, with our former superintendent, public school instruction, Bill Honig, he had been involved in promoting a program that had money going to a nonprofit that his wife worked at. And even though it was a great program and it helped school districts and it helped parent engagement at a school district and local level, he was found guilty of violating Government Code 1090, eventually got probation, didn't go to jail, but was forever barred from holding public office in the state of California. You also have another layer of conflict of interest law, the Political Reform Act. Political Reform Act applies to the exact same public officials, board administrators throughout. It's a little more forgiving, though, because if you're a public official, you're participating or you're attempting to participate in a governmental decision, and you have a qualifying financial interest, which I'll cover on the next slide, you can at least recuse yourself from the decision-making process. You can disclose it and recuse, and then the organization as a whole can continue to go forward. Again, the idea here is if you have a financial interest in this matter that's coming before the organization, you shouldn't be talking about it, shouldn't be involved in it, shouldn't be negotiating it, shouldn't be bringing it forward, and ultimately, you shouldn't be acting on it. So conflict of interest code, the second law, Political Reform Act, requires you to have a conflict of interest code, which you do. And it states who's going to, in your organization, file Form 700s, which are statements of economic interest. Those of you who are on the board know this. Those of you who are on the senior administrative team know this. I know this because I fill out a Form 700 for your organization. And it discloses certain categories of financial interests that allow the public to monitor whether or not the board and or the administrators are being involved in decisions in which they have a financial interest. That's its primary purpose. All state level, local level, city, county, government people file Form 700s. They're held at the code body organization, city, county, charter school, et cetera, and are available for public inspection at any time. It's called a Statement of Economic Interest or Form 700. It has to be filed when you assume office or within 30 days of taking office by April 1st annually, and it looks backwards at the assets you held over the last 12 months. And you have to fill one out again after you leave within 30 days. If you don't, and the Fair Political Practices Commission that oversees this part of the conflict of interest laws does occasionally audit this, you can be subject to fines and penalties as much as like $100 a day for failing to file. On the form, these are the financial types of actions that are covered by the Political Reform Act. You have to disclose investments in a business entity of $2,000 or more, real property of $2,000 or more, which again, I always laugh when I get to this slide because it'd be hard to own real property anything less than that. Any source of income greater than $500, a position in a business entity. So if you are a paid officer or employee, or even if you are an unpaid officer of an organization, that has to be disclosed. And people who give you gifts of $50 or more have to be reported in the Form 700. The initial cover level of the form looks a little like this. It has a lot of schedules that are attached that break out into those areas of investments, business interests, real property, et cetera. Certain things do not need to be disclosed on the form: your personal residence, your income from a public agency. But other things do need to be disclosed. Half of your spouse's income. And you might ask, why half? Well, because it's a community property state. So technically, you have a half. If you are married in the state of California, you are interested by half in your spouse's income, which means you're financially interested in where the income is coming from. Now, you only have to report financial interests that are affected by or could be affected by the decisions of the organization. So if you do own a home or a second home in Colorado or Hawaii, and we're assuming we don't operate charter schools in those areas or we don't do professional development in those areas, then you don't have to report those kinds of assets. Property within a 2-mile jurisdiction of the school or a facility of the school is considered per se reportable. And again, investments in businesses within the jurisdiction have to be reported as well. So if you own a paper supply company, but they only operate at San Francisco, and let's just say they don't do business online, then you wouldn't have to report that kind of a business because it's outside the jurisdiction where your organization operates. So gifts, generally, it's just a great idea that you don't accept gifts worth $50 or more because you have to report them on the Form 700s. You can accept gifts more than $50, up to $500, but nothing in excess of $500. Now, there are exceptions, and you'll see pretty clearly right now what this is getting at is people that are trying to lobby you. So if it's a holiday or a birthday or an inheritance or from family members or a spouse or even longtime good friends and there's reciprocal gift giving, those types of gifts don't need to be reported. But the types of gifts that you get from your lawyer or your accountant that's not reciprocal, they're unilateral. Those types of gifts, if they exceed the amount, do have to be reported. If you do get a gift in excess of $500, you can donate the entirety of it and don't have to report it, or you could donate a portion of it. Say you get two tickets to the Super Bowl and they're $450 each. You can donate one of them, keep the other, and report it. So there is also overlaying to 90 in the Political Reform Act, there are common law conflicts of interest, two different types. One is intended to capture all those other clashes between your personal interest and the interest of the organization that aren't financial. So a great example of this is if you're a board member and you have a student in one of the schools, that's something you as a board member, if there were a disciplinary action against the student or maybe even against the teacher that your students, you know, there was involvement involving your child, there's an appearance of impropriety. There's a lack of impartiality that people are going to imply because of your direct involvement. And so, again, you have to be aware of both financial and non-financial potential conflicts. And those are the sort of things you would disclose on the record and recuse yourself from involvement. And then lastly, there's a doctrine of incompatible offices. So you typically cannot hold offices that have overlapping responsibility. Now, you would think in charter school, where would that be? Well, we've had certain agencies opine that as a charter school board member, you can't be on the county board of education, or as a charter school board member, you couldn't be on the city or county planning commission, for example. If there are facilities that you own that are within that jurisdiction, there is the possibility for code enforcement and those sort of things. And so there's a doctrine of incompatible offices. You can't, they say, serve two masters, even though I know that word is not acceptable anymore, but you can't serve two fiduciary and possibly inconsistent obligations at the same time. All right, Kayla, I'm going to turn it over to you to do...
Well, if I may add, which is an important information, the conflict of interest and the Form 700, that is in the charter petition. That means that our authorizers check for that every year. When we have our annual site visit, whether the SBE, the State Board of Education, the San Diego Unified School District, they always request a copy of the Form 700 to ensure that we are complying with the code.
Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate that. Kayla, you want to, I'll do the slides here.
All right, perfect. Good afternoon, everyone. Kayla Haydu. We are going to spend the next few minutes talking about charter renewal. And it's been a long time since we've been thinking about this. There was the 2-year extension on all charter terms. So it's been a long hiatus. And now there are these new rules. There are new requirements under Assembly Bill 1505. And it was kind of an interesting thing. We were all ramping up to start this process under the new laws. And then the schools got the 2-year extension. But we did live under AB 1505 for 1 year. It was the height of COVID year 2020, 2021. And we were out there getting renewals approved. Then everyone got the 2-year extension. But that 1 year did give us some context for everything that we'll talk about today. So we're going to go through 5 sections on charter renewal: submission, renewal criteria, which is different for DOS schools, charter elements, approval and denial standards, and charter appeal. Okay, so this is just before we even get into those, this is about making the best case that you can for your renewal. So it's about anticipating any challenges that might arise. If your authorizer is asking any sort of financial questions, governance questions, that might clue you into there being a greater issue that might come up at renewal if they're not resolved or remedied by that time. So that the first point is just, you know, anticipate what you can, use forethought. The next one is start the renewal process early, and this is more important than ever. It helps. We'll talk a little bit later about the appeal rights and how those have changed under 1505, but starting the process as soon as possible, like we're recommending that if your charter is up, say, June 2024, that you would actually submit your renewal petition on July 1st of 2023. So you have essentially an entire year, potentially even before that, but 1505 made it even more important to get started on that early. The next point is kind of the point that I already made: look out for possible landmines. Think about what the authorizers are requesting from you. Use that as insight. And then look for opportunities to be helpful to the authorizer. I know that you all do a nice job doing what you can to maintain positive relationships. All right, let's jump into section one. So the first section, charter submission. Some of the changes to AB 1505 that we saw center around this actual process of submitting the renewal petition itself. And this is actually one of the areas that charter schools got a couple of pretty big wins. The first being that we now have a definitive timeline. So AB 1505 gave us for the first time a clear, concrete understanding of when the clock actually starts ticking. And it's really quite a departure from what we lived under before, where there were no clear rules. And now we do have these standardized measures. So what that means is that the charter petition, as it says here, is deemed received by the chartering authority board on the day that it's submitted to the district or county office with a certificate of completeness. That starts the clock, and then there are 60 days from that date until public hearing, and then 90 days from that date until decision. So great, that gave us clarity on what we can expect. As there was previously, there's a 30-day extension with mutual agreement. And then another huge win, the district now has to provide public staff recommendations, including recommended findings, 15 days before the decision meeting. And this is big, this is huge. Previously, most districts and counties would not give us anything ahead of time. So we'd basically get the materials when and if they had to post them in accordance with the Brown Act. So sometimes that was effectively 72 hours before the decision meeting. And if the decision meeting was on a Monday at 5, we would have gotten the materials at Friday at 5. But now we have this full 15 days, a luxurious 2 weeks that allows us and the school to work together to come up with a comprehensive response. The decision meeting is a public hearing. And during this last point here, during the decision meeting, we're supposed to get equivalent time and procedures to present evidence and testimony, to respond to those staff recommendations and findings that we got 15 days prior. We'll see how that works out in practice, but the idea in the law is supposed to afford charter schools more due process rights. The idea there being that we're trying to avoid the situation we had so often where we would do our presentation and then the district or county staff would go for 3 times longer than we did. And then all sorts of new questions would come up and details would come out. This is supposed to equalize that. And we have gotten some indication of what that's actually going to look like in real life, in real terms. I will say many authorizers are being very respectful of equivalent time. So they'll say, you can have as much time as we took, or you can have 10 minutes, whichever one is greater. But it can cut both ways. One time under these new rules, Janelle Rulli, the partner in our firm who predominantly handles the charter renewals, was at a district board meeting on renewal. The district council spoke for 2 minutes and 45 seconds, and then she was expected to only speak for 2 minutes and 45 seconds. So it can cut both ways. Obviously, that was really challenging. But on the whole, if the authorizer does follow the law and does uphold this equivalent time and procedures, it's very much going to be to our benefit.
Unfortunately, we're probably going to end up litigating this already against a couple schools that aren't complying with the law so well. But we'll see.
Yeah. All right. Just like that, we are in Section 2. This is about charter renewal criteria. Most charter schools under AB 1505 are now sorted into 3 categories. They're either deemed high, middle, or low performing. And this was just a major, major change of AB 1505. So whereas before a charter school was a charter school, they were all kind of on an equal playing field and were all eligible for this 5-year term. Now there are these different requirements in order to prove up renewal, and there are different outcomes when it comes to the term length. But there is this separate designation for DOS schools, Dashboard Alternative Status Schools. There's different eligibility requirements for them. And of course, Charter School of San Diego and Adeo Charter School are both DOS schools. So for DOS, maybe go to the next one. The metrics are different, as I mentioned. If you are a DOS school, what you do instead is you have a meeting with the chartering authority and you talk to them and you mutually agree about what alternative metrics it makes sense for your school to be using when it comes to renewal. So we're supposed to meet to mutually agree to discuss those metrics. And then after that meeting, the chartering authority is supposed to send you a letter and say, okay, we met, here are the metrics that we're going to use. And this has happened in a lot of different ways in real life. Sometimes the school district or county board is willing to let the charter school take the lead. Obviously, on the charter school side, we find that to be the best approach. Sometimes school districts and county offices are really engaged and take the law to its most plain meaning. So they'll hold a meeting as they're required to. They'll talk to the charter school, and then they'll decide what the alternative metrics will be. One thing we don't want to have happen is for it to be summer of 2023, your charter term is up in 2024, and nobody's talked, nobody's had a conversation. So we suggest reaching out, sending an email, having that conversation early so that you are fully prepared to come renewal, something that I know you all and the staff are doing. There's also no legal requirement. So unlike the high, middle, low, for DAW schools, there's no legal requirement for specified terms. For high performing non-DAW schools, they get a 7-year term. For middle performing, they get a 5-year term. There is no legal requirement specified in the law for what the term length should be for DAW schools. So that's a little bit different. All right, section 3. Let's talk a little bit about charter elements and the changes that many schools have seen since they were last renewed. As you'll see here in this description here, the law requires a reasonably comprehensive description of any new requirement of charter schools enacted into law after the charter was originally granted or last renewed. So this is just changes to the law that have happened since your last renewal. And there have been a lot. So I'm going to go over a couple of these just quickly, just to refresh the memories. The first is that element 7 changed. If you recall, it used to be that the school had to show how it was going to show a racial and ethnic balance of the pupils that was representative of the balance in the school district. So have the same balance. Now they've expanded it. So in addition to the racial and ethnic balance, there also has to be some equality with the special education pupils and the English learner pupils. So we just saw that one expand out there. Another new requirement, the names and relevant qualifications of all persons whom the petition nominates to serve on the governing body of the charter school. That's a kind of a convoluted way just to say the names and qualifications of your board members. And it doesn't necessarily need to be extraordinarily long. A nice bio paragraph would be sufficient there. Throughout charter law, as you'll see listed here, there have been a myriad of changes, including governing law and affirmation, governance changes, health and safety changes, admission, suspension and expulsion. And we've seen a trend with the Assembly Ed Committee recently seems to have been applying a lot of their new laws to both school districts and also explicitly to charter schools. So they're continually adding these new laws and requirements. Health and safety, admission, suspension, expulsion, those usually change year to year, so that's not terribly surprising. Charter schools are actually not required to comply with suspension and expulsion laws of traditional public schools. However, many do follow the list of enumerated offenses, which just changes all the time. Those changes just quickly, that's just something to be mindful of. And that's something that we can talk with the schools about as its renewal comes up. All right, section 4, approval denial standards. Usually when schools think about their submitting their charter, one of the first things that comes to mind is the denial standard. How can they deny it? But on the other side of the coin, there are actually these approval standards. And so I really want to underscore that under AB 1505, the statute really did maintain that legislative intent that's really in our favor, that the chartering authority, it says that the chartering authority shall grant a charter. So the default through that language is for a charter to be approved, shall grant a charter for the operation of a school under this part if it's satisfied that granting the charter is consistent with sound educational practice. And they did add this language about, and with the interest of the community in which the school is proposing to locate. This last bullet point here, renewals of charters are governed by the standards and criteria described in section 47605. That's just a reminder that the renewals and the initial criteria are governed by the same thing. So that part has not changed. For DOS schools, as we've discussed, the charter is reviewed according to alternative metrics, and the charter may deny only with written findings that the closure of the charter school is in the best interest of students. And I find that to be a really high bar, that a DOS school would be denied for that would be something that I would find surprising. Section 5, we're just steaming along here. A couple notes on charter appeals. The charter appeal process has changed dramatically and unfortunately not necessarily in the charter school's favor. One good piece of news is that we still have full de novo rights, clean slate at the county level. If you have a district authorizer and they deny, you still have a full review, clean slate at the county level. But, you know, as we have here, it used to be that we had de novo review, that clean slate also at the state board, and that tended to be a pretty good safety net most of the time for overzealous districts and counties that were denying. They've changed that now to be, they'll only do a review when there's this abuse of discretion, as you can see there in red. That's an undefined term of art, another unfortunate thing. But we do know that it's an incredibly high bar to meet. So we can no longer count on the state as the safety net that it once was for us. Timeline here, I just want to make sure you know, I think the most important thing here is that you only have 30 days to appeal a denied establishment charter and a denied renewal charter. 30 days comes really quickly, so it's just, you know, important to get on top of that. Again, I don't think that Charter School of San Diego or Adeo Charter School are, you know, going to be facing that, but it's an important timeline to keep in mind. And then there's 180 days for judicial review if the county doesn't act or the state board fails to act. All right, appeals to the county looks largely the same as it did before. It still gets submitted to the county and it's subject to de novo review, as I said. One thing that's important here, there's just a procedural addition. The appeal now has to be submitted to the school district at the same time it's submitted to the county. So if it's denied by the school district and then you're appealing to the county, that appeal petition has to be given to both the county and the district at the same time. Obviously, if you're submitting electronically, that's easy. If you're submitting in person, I think that there probably would be a reasonableness standard where you can't be in two places at the same time. We've talked about, did we just skip one? Yeah. Let's include findings. So we've talked about the fact that State Board of Education is now harder to get, right? There's no longer this de novo review, this clean slate. There's this abuse of discretion standard. What you have to do under there is to even do the appeal, the charter school needs to submit findings and documentary evidence from both the district and the county. And then the district and county then need to prepare a documentary record, which should include transcripts. And they have to do that for you no later than 10 business days after the request. So it's a tight turnaround for them. We then have to cite specific places in the record where they went wrong. So you can't just be ambiguous. You need to say, you know, at this time, they said this, and that was the incorrect standard upon which they were making their decision. Mm-hmm. At this point, when you're submitting a charter appeal to the state board, you have to provide a copy to both the district and county, so everyone gets the appeal. And then if there are new or different materials for any reason, this part is just kind of weird. It actually remands to the district. So if you put in new information, there could potentially be an oddity where you're actually going back to the district and the district is going to have to reassess your charter petition. That's obviously going to be a strategic point depending on how the relationship is with the authorizer of the district and where you are at the appeal process if you've submitted in time and, you know, other such strategic things that we can discuss with you. But it's just an interesting provision in the law. Okay, appeal to the State Board of Education. The district or county may submit an opposition. They almost always took it upon themselves to do that anyway, but this codifies their right. The actual mechanism is different now. So the ACCS holds a public hearing to review the appeal and the record. And then they actually make a recommendation to the FBE, to the state board, about whether there's sufficient evidence to hear the appeal. So this means that the state board is not even necessarily going to hear it. They can accept the ACCS's recommendation not to and just move on. All right, go to the next one. If the state board does hear it, it's like I've said multiple times now, it's under an abuse of discretion standard, which again, high standard, hard to overturn. And then if the FBE does hear it, does reverse, they will designate either the district or county as the authorizer. And just quickly, before we move on to revocation, I wanted to give some additional context on the three appeals that we have seen at the State Board of Education level. There's been these three different charter appeals. They went through all this summer, one in July and two during the September meeting, so very recently. And the overall track record on those is that one out of three was approved by the State Board. And when I say approved, that means they overturned the denial at the district or county level, and then they delegated the chartering authority to one of those. In the first appeal, a lot of the procedural requirements that I talked about earlier, like the equivalent time procedures, the requirement that the district prepare a transcript, a lot of those procedural requirements were violated. And so that's what the appeal was based on, the violation of these new requirements, their legal requirements under AB 1505. And what was demonstrated by the CDE and the state board there was that a violation of those requirements alone is not really enough. It's not enough to convince them to overturn a charter denial. They are apparently, although the law, I should mention, makes no mention of this and explicitly requires the things I just mentioned, like the equivalent time and procedures. They're apparently looking for some sort of nexus between the harm that was done and the procedural violation. So, for example, if the district takes 30 minutes to present and only gives the charter school 10, we have to somehow show a direct harm here. You would think it would be obvious that we only get one third of the time to be able to make our case, yet they didn't really seem to grasp that. The second appeal involved a charter that was submitted to a district that is still in technical terms in state receivership. So it has about 2 years left to pay down its loan. It's totally on track to do so. It has a lot of reserves. I think it's like $30 million in reserves. But what the law says in that case, when a school district is in a receivership, there's a rebuttable presumption of denial of the charter, which the charter school is rebuttable. So the charter school can overcome that. They can show that the district is in a financial position to be able to absorb any fiscal impact. And what was difficult about this one is that the state board decided to not even hear the merits of it. So there was no hearing. They decided to summarily deny the charter, not actually hear it. And they did so because of the fact that it was in receivership, basically ignoring all the evidence presented that the district could absorb it, that they had this $30 million in reserves. So again, that was challenging. The one charter that was approved, meaning that the state board overturned the denials at the district and county levels, that was the situation of it was a brand new school, a startup school, submitted to the district. The district had a lot of bad procedures, like egregiously bad procedures. The county also didn't follow all the procedures, and that was enough. The State Board of Education decided that that was different enough, that was horrible enough, and they decided to approve it. So I just wanted to give you all a little bit of additional context there. 1-3 was not the track record that any of us had before the pandemic. So we'll see what happens next round. And like Paul mentioned earlier, there may be some litigation between now and the next round. And our general sense is that perhaps the state board and their legal counsel are happy to wait for a court to tell them what to do. But I just wanted to give some additional context there before moving on to another very exciting topic, revocation. So revocation, I'm going to go through this section incredibly quickly because it is not something that I'm worried about for your school, but I do want The main point that I want to make in this section is that a chartering authority can only revoke a charter after providing due process and using specified procedures. And there are a lot of requirements, and they're articulated in the Education Code and in its implementing regulations. So here, as it says on this first slide, in the absence of a severe and imminent threat, which has different standards, a chartering authority can only revoke the charter if it makes a factual finding specific to that school and supported by substantial evidence that the charter school has done one of these four things. One, committed a material violation of the charter. Two, failed to meet or pursue any of the pupil outcomes identified in the charter. Three, there were fiscal issues, failed to meet generally accepted accounting principles, engaged in fiscal mismanagement, and finally, violated any law. And then before any revocation, the chartering authority must first take action to approve, and then they have to deliver this notice of violation. And the notice of violation has to identify the alleged violations, of course, and the evidence that they relied upon in coming up with those violations. Each alleged violation also has to be material. It can't be something that's inconsequential and uncured. There also has to be a reasonable remedy period. So if they bring something to your attention, you have to have an opportunity to be able to fix it. There also has to be notice of the notice of violation, and it has to be in a public meeting 72 hours prior to any public meeting in which the authorizer is considering the notice of violation. They have to provide you with the notice and all the relevant materials at that time. So at least 72 hours before, so that you have at least a little bit of an opportunity to respond. The charter school then has this opportunity to respond, and they can submit a detailed response. They can refute, they can offer to remediate, say that it's already been remediated since they brought it up. Generally, as I said, those are pretty comprehensive. From there, the chartering authority will either decide, okay, you know, you've remedied, and they'll just continue revocation, or they'll continue revocation by going to this next step, this notice of intent to revoke. One quick point here on the notice of intent to revoke, it can only be issued if there's substantial evidence that the charter school has failed to remedy a violation, or failed to refute to the board's satisfaction. All right, and then we have this appeal process. There is an appeal process at both the district and county level. And interestingly, if the district decides to revoke and then the county board overturns that revocation, the district itself can appeal to the state board. All right, I know that was incredibly fast. I'm trying to be very respectful of your all time, but now I will turn it over to Paul.
Good stuff. Thanks, Kayla. Appreciate it. I mean, we're all, like you said, everybody's facing the renewals, and we're watching the field, and we're watching what's going on as more and more districts are fighting for kids because many more and more districts are declining enrollment, which puts interesting and unfortunate pressure on charter schools. But so now we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the things that have gone wrong for charters and charter authorizers and some of the executive officers over the last 20 years, and that have obviously led to, in some places, actually the closure of very successful schools, but in some other places not. There are arguably inconsistent provisions in the Charter Schools Act that regulate the expenditure of money. We've got this quoted language here from the Charter Schools Act that says general purpose entitlement, which is, by the way, an old term in art that was used before we had LCFF local control funding. Provision says can be used for any public purpose determined by the governing board of the charter school. Fair enough, broad. That's the flexibility charter schools were entitled to. But then LCFF came along and said, you've got to have an LCAP and you've got to dictate what you're going to do and how you're going to spend your money. And so now there's some limitation on how much you can reorganize funding outside what you've already said you were going to use for purposes of supporting your LCAP. And then you have just the general construct that money given to charter schools is public monies. And you'll see this in the criminal lawsuits that we're talking about in a little bit, because it comes from provisions that apply to public agency embezzlement and misappropriation. Then we have the private sector laws like the Nonprofit Integrity Act of 2004 that applies to charitable organizations, that at least as it relates to a charter school, as we'll talk about in a moment, just talks about making sure there isn't private inurement outside and excessive compensation. And then we have the conflict of interest laws we've talked about in financial constraints and some other provisions in the Corporations Code that mirror some of those conflict of interest provisions. So the two big areas that have tripped up some charter school authorizers, charter school operators, has been embezzlement and misappropriation of public funds. And I say tripped up because as you'll see here in the elements, the line is not drawn in the sand as clearly as one would like, especially when you're talking about penal code application of laws. But you have embezzlement, where you've got spending money outside the authority of its use. All right. Well, I just talked about the use of the money is pretty broad. So what is the authority defining its use? But with embezzlement, there's a fraudulent intent. It's a little easier to prove embezzlement. It's like, all right, you knew the money was for X, and you knew you spent it on Y. In most cases, in embezzlement, it's that Y is what they spend on themselves. So embezzlement's not the bigger issue. The bigger one is misappropriation of public funds, which even by its own title is a bit vague, right? If a person charged with receipt, safekeeping, and transfer of public monies who, without the authority of law, appropriates the same for his or her own personal use or the use of another, again, pretty general terms. Loans the same. Okay, well, don't make loans. That's good to stay away from. Knowingly keeps a false account. Well, in one prosecution, we'll talk about the monies were used to support things that they thought believed were lawful expenditures for the organization, gift cards, flowers for board members, and things like that we'll talk about. And then the audit reports reflected those expenditures. And then the DA came in and said, yeah, well, now you're keeping a false account. If you fraudulently or alter or falsify, conceal records, okay, that's bad. Don't do that. Everybody knows that. Willfully admit to transfer money when it's required by law. People understand, don't do that. So with misappropriation, as you'll see with some of the examples that we're going to give here shortly, it's punishable by imprisonment. There have been a few executive directors, unfortunately, and officers over the years who have been convicted of these embezzlement or misappropriation of public funds. Then you have the False Claims Act, which, by the way, does not apply to public school districts because the courts have interpreted the law as saying they are not entities subject to these laws because we don't want the public fisc to be hurt by claims of false claims. Well, wait a minute. I just told you money's going to a charter school are public monies. Why wouldn't the result under these laws be the same? Well, this is the sometimes unfortunate world charter schools live in, because you are both partly a public agency and partly a nonprofit. Sometimes you get stuck with laws that apply to one or the other. And in this case, nonprofits can get stuck with False Claims Act. These are places where you knowingly present a false or recklessly, you do it in a reckless way, submit a false claim for funding. So if you're going for funding on a state or federal grant, or typically here ADA money, and you falsify records or you make up records after the fact to justify what you've claimed, or you conspire with somebody to do that, you can violate the False Claims Act. And when you do that, or if you even receive money under wrongful, it's been garnered under a false claim and you keep it and don't give it back, you can also violate the False Claims Act. But any person who commits a false claim, and there have been allegations against a few non-classroom-based charter schools because of the difficulty in record keeping for non-classroom-based attendance, that you can be sought by a private party or the attorney general for three times the amount of damages, the cost of being litigated. So they get the attorney general or the DA gets to come after you for the cost of the trial if you lose, and then a civil penalty of $5,000 up to $11,000 for each violation, and each transaction counts as their own violation. So False Claims Act claims are very costly to defend. Then you've got the additional limitations on the use of funds. Like I said, nonprofit corporation talks about private inurements. You can't operate for the benefit of, you have to operate for the benefit of a charitable purpose, not for a private purpose. And this comes into play when you have related parties that are for-profits, usually, and we've seen a few charter schools that have set up related parties that are for-profits that might trigger a concern that the nonprofit's being run just essentially to funnel money over the for-profit or private enrollment. And then if you get into excess compensation issues where you don't conduct a comparability study when you're doing salary for senior administrators, then you can get into a situation where someone claims excess compensation. But thankfully, in almost 30 years, we've never had one of those situations arise. But to point out some of the inconsistencies in the code and that lead to difficulty in fully understanding the flexibility charter schools have, we have one provision here quoted at the top. Funding may be used for any public school purpose determined by the governing board, versus a new provision at the bottom that says, effectively, the governing board of a charter school shall use all money it receives for the benefit of the charter school in the fiscal year that it receives it. Well, wait a minute. I mean, that can't mean exactly what it means. Some charter schools and all have to carry some reserve for economic uncertainty. Does that mean that, you know, charter school that or a charter management organization that operates three charter schools can't use charter school A money to help B with cash flow issues? It's really unclear. The idea behind the Charter Schools Act was to give charter schools as much, if not more, flexibility than school districts. School districts, a unified district, can move money around between the high schools and the elementary schools or have a declining enrollment school all they want. And we think that charter schools have and still do hold a lot of that flexibility, but the legislature keeps tinkering with the code and creating some of these uncertainties, unfortunately. So let's look at a couple of case studies, unfortunate situations where Eugene Silvanoff was an executive director, founder, developer of a charter school early, late 1990s to the early 2000s, and was convicted on 24 counts of embezzlement and misappropriation of public funds. This one is probably the most troubling of all of them from my perspective, because the things that the DA charged were they did professional development at TGI Fridays, and they bought beer and alcohol for the teachers. They bought gift cards for the teachers for just walking down the hallway and rewarding people for doing good things. They bought flowers for the LAUSD board chair, on and on, things like that, that clearly a nonprofit can do. And clearly they're lawful expenditures of a nonprofit that the LA County fiscal officer came in and said, those are all disallowed expenditures, not a term, by the way, in the law. And in this case, there were other things that Mr. Silvanoff had done as it related to rental payments to an entity that he had controlled that I think were the sort of the tip of the iceberg here that led to his conviction for misappropriation and embezzlement. Jeremy Landau, though, is a different situation. This is one of those ones where you get someone who comes to you and says, if you give me $750,000 today, next week, I'll give you $3 million. And believe it or not, even though you get probably 10 emails a week that say that, which we all know are spam now, this particular school, unfortunately, gave him the $750,000 and lo and behold, he disappeared. Obviously, a scam. And he was facing and charged with 16 counts of money laundering, misappropriation of public funds, et cetera, not surprisingly. Now, early on in the charter schools movement, Marion Lynn and some go back far enough to remember Stephen Cox, the founder of California Charter Academy, outsized personality, had 36 schools, grew super fast, but then started creating for-profit organizations and hired his family and daughters and wife and all these people, and then just had these lavish vacations and trips and all sorts of stuff that was going on. Again, when he was being investigated, he just shut down all the schools mid-year. There were thousands of kids that were displaced. It was really, really messy. This one, from a legal perspective, I'm sorry, I always leave on the slide because he has been facing trial since 2007 and has not gone to trial yet for one reason or another. The records are massive. He had a lawyer that I think that died. He had other lawyers that quit, and he's being prosecuted with the former city mayor. And for some reason, this case has just never gone to trial, but he's still facing 56 counts of conflicts, misappropriation of public funds, et cetera. Now, here's one that, again, is a little more close to the case where the executive director was really trying to help the school, I believe. In this case, the executive director of Ways Academy had a facility that she wanted to and did lease back to the school at a reduced price, below market. But the Fair Political Practices Commission that comes in and oversees the Political Reform Act found that that was a violation of the Political Reform Act, which I talked about earlier, because she was involved. She had a financial interest in this, and she was involved in negotiating and signing lease agreements. So they fined this particular executive director $16,000 fine for violating that. And then we had another executive director, Vilka McFarland, who ended up pleading guilty to one count of embezzlement of public funds and conspiracy to misappropriate at a federal level, had set up very elaborate multiple corporations, and money was going to different corporations. And again, when she employed, I think, her brother and different people. And there were allegations, which I think seemed to be supported, that she used the credit card for luxury travel. She went back to the Obama inauguration and things like that. That led to her downfall, unfortunately, as a charged cooperator as well. So all of the things, and just stop me here, Kayla, I can't remember where we sort of...
Yeah, I think that...
There you go. You're up. Yeah.
All right. So born out of the case studies that Paul just talked about and other real life experiences that we've seen, the next two slides just bullet point areas that could potentially lead to criminal liability. Some are pretty obvious. Others are a little bit more surprising. With all, one key to fraud detection and deterrence is just to develop internal controls, set up systems where you ensure that these things are not happening. Now, you all do have your travel and expense reimbursement policy that sets this up really nicely. It's aligned with what you'll see on these next two slides here, and clearly delineates what expenses are reimbursable and what expenses are not reimbursable. It also sets maximums for meals while out on travel for the school even. And so it really aligns very well with these. But these are the type of things that can raise some eyebrows or just straight out are not, certainly not advisable and potentially are illegal. First, business class travel, wine, beer, alcohol, expensive meals. As I said, you have a cap on each of those, which is great. Expenditures not directly related to school purposes. This one's a little tougher, like, you know, a holiday party for your staff. That can be suspect. Travel for staff or board members not directly related to school purposes. That one, I think, is fairly obvious. Gifts, flowers. Paul mentioned that Eugene Silivanov had given flowers to the LAUSD board, even that sort of thing. Again, purchasing personal items, of course, car leases, loans to employees, never a good idea. That $750,000, you know, just went away and never came back. Renting an apartment or condo, of course, large employee expense accounts, gym or golf club memberships. As I said, some of these are pretty obvious. Gift cards, payments of debts on behalf of other people, payments to vendors that have those familial ties. Again, Paul kind of broke that down. And then political contribution donations. That's our list there. And then transfers of funds between schools operated by the same nonprofit corporation are also under attack. And it's important to note here, though, first of all, this is all in the context of what Paul talked about under the sort of conflict that we're seeing before between 47633 and 41370. You know, that it's trying to restrict spending, but in a way that doesn't necessarily make sense. One important note here is that the state auditor has said that transfers are okay as long as certain conditions are met. It needs to be temporary. It's not something where one school is perpetually giving money to another. There's no impact to the educational program of the school that's actually loaning money. It's board approved. The board knows about it, has approved it. And another thing of note is that FICMAT is even more supportive of transfers than the state auditor is, at least as it pertains to independent study schools, with the caveat that both of these things were before the new change in the law under 413-41370.
But I'm not the only one who has trouble. It's outside the Charter Schools Act, so I can't remember that. Yeah.
Right. Transfers of funds, again, just on along a similar line. Intellectual property and transfers of funds between schools is, again, under attack. Again, you all have something, a great system in place. You have an allocation policy, and you also have your memorandum of understanding between SSP and Adeo Charter School Corporation regarding the intellectual property. Here, we're also recommending consulting with legal counsel before transferring funds to other charter schools, not using charter school funds for purposes other than operating a California charter school, and to use private segregated funds if you do want to develop an out-of-state school. The next two slides cover developing appropriate safeguards, many of which, as I said, you all have in place. Did you have a question, Eric?
Yes, I do. I don't know if I read that right. First, apologies to everyone for being a little late. I might have held things up. But I thought this slide a few slides ago said that the new law says you have to spend all funds in the current year. But I've been on the board for a couple of years now. I've been very impressed with the surpluses that the schools run. So I'm a little confused on how that ties together or doesn't.
I think interpreting it the way we have is that using the funds for the school, including putting it in budget as a reserve for economic uncertainty, counts for allocating it for the school. So instead of transfer, I think the main part of that provision was to say, don't use these funds for other purposes. And interestingly, it included school districts, counties, and then charter schools. So it means, you know, it was trying to lock down a paradigm that, you know, charter school money for and school district money for one particular school should be used for that school and not, you know, used willy-nilly, for example, for all the other schools. So I think as long as you're taking the money and you're budgeting it by school, spending it by school and or reserving it for that school, you're using it for that school.
Paul, I would contend that our governance, which includes strategic reserves and operating expenses in our budget, does exactly that.
Yeah.
So per our governance, we put a certain amount of money away to make absolutely certain we have 6 months of operating expenses and, you know, all of those other things, to include establishing strategic reserve for development and all those other things. That's consistent with a, if you will, a nonprofit legitimate expense of funds during the year secured.
There's also the other way that Kayla and I have read this, because there is the proviso that says, except as may otherwise specifically provided by law in that 41370, there is another provision in the Charter Schools Act that gives you, the board, the authority to spend money any way that you deem to be the best interest to your kids. So charter schools, I think, actually have that layer of more flexibility than school districts and counties do.
Plus, many years ago, we passed a policy. And from what we understood, it was one of the first of its kind. It was a policy which very clearly designated what proportion of funds would be reserved for what. In other words, a certain percent goes into economic uncertainty, and there's a formula for it, strategic planning. And I always forget what the third one is, Lynn.
Yeah, it's a general operational reserve, which is not your, it's not part of your fund balance or equity. It's really when you develop a budget. But the other two, economic uncertainty is part of your equity or fund balance and the strategic reserves. And you are right, the board approved that, and they are earmarked for certain purposes.
And
that's what I was referring to.
Any funds,
I know that we passed that policy.
Pardon me?
That's what I was referring to. I know that we passed that policy to establish those particulars.
Right.
So that the board gave direction specifically in the budgeting process to ensure that we had those funds.
And within those three broad areas, there are specific funds that are designated specific use. For example, our self-insured policy, our covering leases, you know, in case something were to happen, that kind of thing.
Right. And the management is brilliant, which is why those reserves are there. It just seems like the reserves get to a certain point where they're big enough, and although they're allocated here and there, that there's finally enough money to go, say, buy a property for cash. I don't know if that skirts. I know you guys have it covered. I just don't quite understand the whole thing. Don't need to belabor it here.
I think it's important that the board understand it. That is an approach that we use to purchasing, to acquiring property, rather than settle, in my mind, our schools with a mortgage, which has a real impact on the operation over the course of time. Instead, we designate funds for the purchase of property and just wait and not buy the property until we have the funds to purchase them in cash. And we think that that is a very sound, conservative approach to sustainability. And sustainability is critically important to every board that we've worked with.
Right. So it almost sounds like they wrote this new code in so that when you're super efficient, you can't benefit from it. So it almost seems like that's exactly the kind of thing they're trying to stop, right? They're trying to stop the charter school from being efficient and then leveraging their efficiency into future efficiencies. So as long as everybody's on the same page there and it's on the table and Paul and Kayla understand, then, and we're good, then fine by me.
Is that, of course, we've done everything under your counsel, Paul, but that does address the current law and any innuendos that the law has, doesn't it? Paul, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. You couldn't interpret my lip reading. I think the way you're good on your policy and the way you allocate your expenses and revenue and the way you hold back reserves and make those budget decisions for your organization. Yeah, no, you have a very low debt ratio as well because of all that. Kayla, you were on this. Yeah.
Just thank you, Eric. Back to developing these appropriate safeguards. So we just are giving here 10 internal controls that your school should have. As I've stated, you all have these. You have checks and balances, segregation of duties, reconciliation reports are also advised, timely reviewed and approved by management. Not allowing school credit cards, or if for any reason they are allowed, very, very, very strictly controlling them. Board of directors oversight, especially of executive directors or principal expenses, fiscal policies and procedures, again, which you all have developed. And then there's just a few more on the next slide.
Interject something, Kayla, that I just,
yes, please.
I don't forget. You know, another important piece of that law and actually what provoked consideration of what charter schools were doing with their funds is investments. We've never been involved in any risky investments, and so we are our money mostly resides with the county. We have some bank accounts and some CDs, but all of it, we never put any money in any place if it's not the insured account, you know, federally insured accounts. And so I think at one point people were concerned that those funds would be, you know, invested in high risk situations. So I just wanted to reassure and remind the board that we have I don't know if it's a formal policy, but we have a administrative approach that never ever is anything invested in anything in any account that's not protected. But we're always open to suggestions. And we're willing to spend money. We're looking for property continually, all the time. And we're in a good place, actually, because since we'd be paying cash, we aren't subject to the mortgage, the rise in mortgage. So actually, to tell you the truth, it's in our strategic plan. Well, you know this. It's in our strategic plan, and we've been waiting until the appropriate time to really get out there. And we're told that's around 2026, when it'd be a really strategic time to purchase property. But if we were to find some, you know, in the right places, not buy property just to buy property, it has to have some logic in terms of serving kids and where we're looking. We would do that. We're also holding off because, remember, there's a moratorium for 2 years on expanding the charter schools. So unless we're replacing a site, like a lease site with a purchase site, I believe that's okay. But we can't just go out and expand and buy new property. We have to wait till the moratorium's passed and we don't find ourselves sitting on property for a while with not being able to put kids in it. We're very scrupulous about looking at property. We worked very closely with Greg Haggart, which is a chairman of the other board, the corporate board. And he's very familiar with facilities and property and real estate. We work with our real estate people to do a study on where we should be looking for property. So it's not just per se, if I look for property anywhere in the county or in the city. Rather, we've identified in collaboration with our real estate people, specific areas where we're watching until property comes up. Which may be soon, who knows, with the situation like it's going. But we want to be ready. So.
Okay, Paul, go ahead and continue forward.
All right, let's see here. Strict controls on petty cash and other cash funds. Of course, cash just can't be recorded like other transactions can be. Protect checks against fraudulent use. Solid internal controls and, like Paul relayed, avoiding the related party transactions. So those are just some procedural safeguards that we recommend. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Paul. Paul, you're on mute there.
Sorry about that. You've also got a responsibility for maintaining your nonprofit corporate tax structure throughout the life and term of your charter, which is fairly easy to do. You just need to watch a few things. Charter Schools Act allows you to operate as a nonprofit. Unfortunately, by doing so, it does also give your granting agency the authority to put someone on your board, which they're not doing at the moment. A few places in California, they are Northern California. It also provides liability protection for the authorizer. And provides great liability protection for you, I think, as I mentioned in the first part of these workshops, if you're volunteer board members, which you are, you have the highest level of immunity for board service on your board. So you maintain your tax-exempt status, your charitable organization, and which you do annually by filing 990s and 199s in your statement of officers, which your administrative team is doing. And there's five types of activities that you want to avoid that can jeopardize that tax-exempt status. That's private benefit and private inurement we've talked about. We'll cover again briefly. Lobbying, which you're allowed to do, but not in a large degree. Political campaign activity, which you're not allowed to do. And any activities that are outside your charitable purpose that might get you into a business income where it's unrelated to your charitable purpose. Or failure to file some of these forms like the 990 on a regular basis.
Paul, can you comment on the lobbying? Our board is aware that we hire a lobbyist. Yep. We have a lobbyist that works on our behalf.
All right, let's go right to that. Lobbying. So you are allowed to use, you are as a nonprofit public benefit corporation, allowed to use the resources and the nonprofit stage in lobbying. But there's a threshold of what is substantial. And so it's where you are is well below that, given your role. It looks at the overall economic amount of money you have, how much money you're using to do that lobbying. So you're well below that threshold, Mary, with what you're doing. But if you were a small organization and only generating $20,000 a month and you were spending, you know, $16,000 a month on lobbying, then you would not meet that threshold for purposes of lobbying. Political campaign activity. So if you're talking about initiatives or candidates, can't spend the nonprofit's money on that type of activity without jeopardizing the tax exempt status of the organization. And I know your administration is sensitive to that because anytime any of these issues come up, well, we've talked about it beforehand. There's just reporting obligations you guys do a good job of keeping track of and doing and filing annual. If you don't, all of a sudden you can find yourself in a position where your tax exempt status is lost and your nonprofit can be suspended, which has happened to a few charter schools in the state of California. So now let's talk about some updates on where things are going in the state of California. As you know, or you've probably heard us talk about before, we filed a lawsuit on behalf of all of California's non-classroom-based charter schools in a class action challenging the district's disparate treatment of non-classroom-based charter schools because during the pandemic, when they cut off funding in 1 year and we went into lockdown, in the following year, they allowed all LEAs to have growth in enrollment and funding, but did not allow that for non-classroom-based schools. They claimed there was a budget deficit. They didn't have the ability to fund growth in non-classroom-based schools during the 2021 school year. That turned out to be a lie because they had billions of dollars in surplus. And I think they honestly were just worried that people were going to run from classroom-based schools to non-classroom-based schools. And some little bit did because the non-classroom-based schools were a lot better situated when we went into the pandemic to be able to handle and distribute education, high-quality education in a non-classroom-based setting. But as it is, 25,000-plus non-classroom-based students went without funding in that following year. We brought a lawsuit of its first of its kind. It's obviously it's an unusual legal theory in the sense that we are trying to challenge the contractual rights of a charter school to funding in the state of California as a licensed operator of a public school. The trial court disagreed, but we are on appeal to the California Third District Court of Appeal, and I would suspect we'll have an answer sometime next spring on that case.
Paul, is there a reason why there were not, this did not become a class action?
No, it was, Admiral. It became a class action. All 200 and how many? Kayla, 228. I can't remember the exact number. It was a 298.
Yeah.
Non-classroom-based schools. There are four or five lead plaintiffs that are leading the case.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
So if at the end of the day, the lawsuit is successful, which and our sought relief, obviously, is to fully fund all growth, then all the non-classroom-based schools, including Adeo's schools and SSP schools, to the extent they had growth, would be funded as well. Now, during the pandemic, there was a lot of new lawsuits that came out of, unfortunately, the pandemic, one which we didn't think was going to happen, which was an employee trying to claim that they suffered COVID at a work environment because of the lax health and safety standards. Here, a person who worked in the See's Candy distribution center got COVID, came home, and unfortunately passed it on to the spouse who passed away. Now, workers' comp normally would cover those types of injuries, but we've seen a case that's pending on appeal where the trial court create an exception to that workers' comp limitation and said, in the type of case where you fail completely, allegedly, to protect the health and safety of your workers, there might be risk and liability. So the takeaway from this case is reemphasizing the importance of workplace safety measures and protecting your employees and anybody who comes into your immediate sphere from any obvious risk and the like. The allegations here are essentially that they didn't provide any PPE and they were dissuading people from wearing masks and those sort of things early on in the pandemic. Another case, and again, you see trends in the state of California. And we see trends that are pro-employee, and we see sometimes some trends that are pro-plaintiff, like the one I just talked about. Here, this is a pro-employee type of situation where an employee through a private vendor of another organization who suffered wage and hour issues, say they weren't paid on time or not paid properly, et cetera, sued the employer and the organization to which the employer had assigned the employee. And this is, creates what they call a joint employer situation. So in the charter school world, this comes into play when you hire security guards or special education vendor employees. And if you start to exercise a degree of control over that employee who's working for that third party, you could be creating a situation where you're creating a joint employment, which means if that other vendor violates the wage and hour laws and creates liability, you could be jointly and severally liable for those types of situations. It's, again, it's sort of an expansion of to protect employees to be able to make sure that they can adequately secure relief. If they say their employer goes out of business, they've got another layer that they can pursue for purposes of liability. Kayla, you want to jump in on the off-campus speech one?
Yeah. All right. So we're going to go over a few cases about student rights and operations. The first one is one that you might have heard about. This case got a lot of press coverage because it's one of those rare times where the Supreme Court actually took up a case that involves students in schools. So what happened here is a student tried out and failed to make her high school's varsity cheerleading team. She instead made the JV team, and then over the weekend and away from school, she posted a picture of herself on her social media, spewing all sorts of profanities about the school and softball, who apparently she was also involved in, and cheer and everything. The post was visible to about 250 people, many of whom were students and some of whom were cheerleaders. So naturally, the administration found out about it. And what they did is they suspended the student from cheerleading in that next year for violating their school social media policy and the cheerleading code of conduct, which she had signed. The parents in turn sued the school, saying that the district allegedly violated her constitutional rights to protected speech. So as you'll see here, the court held 8-1 in favor of the student and made clear that students don't shred their constitutional rights just by virtue of being students. The court also made clear in this interesting quote here that the school itself has an interest in protecting students' expressions, even if that expression is unpopular, because schools are supposed to operate as America's nurseries of democracy. So they need to uphold these constitutional protections. The court did mention that the student's speech shouldn't cause substantial disruption, and she didn't threaten to harm anyone else when she was doing her rant. The takeaway here is that while schools, of course, should be vigilant about addressing harassment or bullying, they should be careful about penalizing off-campus speech. And the off-campus notion is important here. The Supreme Court has previously upheld the school's ability to control vulgar speech that actually occurs on school grounds. But again, the takeaway here is penalizing off-campus speech could be a violation of protected speech under the Constitution.
This is not a one-off, unfortunately. We have another case right now, even in the office, where this is happening via Instagram. You know, the bullying that you're seeing off-campus, but sort of related to school activities against school colleagues. It's really sad.
Yeah. The unfortunate aspect of this, although, of course, we certainly support free speech and what's off campus is off campus. However, it's a lost opportunity to teach appropriate ways of communicating diverse opinions and at the same time being able to guide students in appropriate manners of discourse. So if you're very unhappy with something, very, very unhappy, you can be very, very unhappy. But there's been appropriate ways of discourse. And I don't know if schools can't offer any guidance or even make reference to off-campus examples of that. Well, then I'm not sure where students would learn the skills associated with appropriate discourse. Remember, schools were established in the first place in order to assure a social contract, which would assure these very rights of free speech. So, you know, there's downsides and upsides to all of these, and I think the schools are challenged in trying to work with them. We're not. We haven't had anything like this, remotely like this, knock on wood. But, you know, I can understand that these schools are placed in a very awkward position.
Yeah.
Especially when you look at the fact that there's a profanity law in California still on the books. And schools are supposed to teach. Schools are supposed to teach the up and coming what's socially acceptable. And there is a profanity law in the state of California. It's still on the books. So they pick and choose what they want.
Well,
that type of profanity shouldn't be accepted anywhere.
Well, as a school, of course, we don't pass judgment on that. Certainly not in our
law is the law.
Yeah. But it is challenging. We really need to stay abreast. That's why these workshops are so important, because it's important to stay abreast of what is required so that, in fact, we can find appropriate, acceptable, and compliant ways of dealing with helping to support our students. And I think we're in a unique situation, you know, because we work in small groups. We don't have a lot of pressures that larger schools have, cheerleading and those things that become so emotional, sports. We focus strictly on academics. And I have to say that's a pleasure. That's a real pleasure. Academics, leadership, social development, that's our focus. And I think our teachers do a really good job of that. But I'm so grateful that you bring this up, Paul, these things, because we have to, you know, give them some thought and consideration.
Well, there's an excellent opportunity with if you can't afford to buy the social media platform, there's an interesting discussion going on right now, obviously, about free speech rights of the public as well with Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter. But I digress. So, Kayla, you want to move on to COVID-19?
Yeah, sure thing.
Yeah.
One question that has come up in the past couple of years is whether school districts and charters have the legal authority to implement their own vaccine policies or vaccine mandates. So just going back a little bit, we know that the Health and Safety Code in California provides a scheme under which California schools, through the legislature, along with the Department of Public Health, can add required vaccines to the current schedule of the 10 required vaccines for in-person instruction. Now, of course, we do not have a current statewide vaccine mandate in California. The governor has issued public statements indicating that in the future would become a requirement. If it's done under executive order, it would be subject to these certain exemptions, religious, personal, and medical exemptions. Action by the legislator would not necessarily be subject to these religious or personal belief exemptions. There was a time, like October 2021, when the governor was really hot on this issue. It seemed to wane a bit, and now any anticipated vaccine mandate has been delayed until at least July of 2023. But the litigation that we saw in the last year addresses the question of whether charter schools and districts do have the authority under the law to impose their own requirements absent that of the statewide mandate. On the state vaccine mandate, as I said, there's no statewide, and so they've come in. The first litigation that we're going to talk about is this Let Them Choose versus San Diego Unified School District. And the key issue there is whether the state's own vaccine law, again, those health and safety codes that charter schools and districts have complied with at the point of admission to ensure that students have those 10 vaccinations on the state schedule, whether that law that's already on the books precludes school districts from adopting their own vaccine requirements in addition, so going beyond what's already required under the state law. And what happened in this case is the San Diego Superior Court struck down the district's mandate on state law grounds. It invalidated their vaccine policy, which requires students over a certain age to have COVID vaccination in order to remain in in-person learning. And the court decided that they were preempted from doing so. So just so you all know, the district has appealed, and it's my understanding that that is a waiting appeal. Now, the next case was interesting. In an earlier case, as I have here, Children's Health Defense versus LA.
Kayla, can you clarify for me?
Yes.
If, in fact, the district were to win that appeal, saying that they had the right to add to the 10 that are already required that we get audited on and all that, the standard 10, then would that be a case that relates only to their district? Or I assume that would be precedent for other districts, but would that require other districts or LEAs like us to also add, have add-ons like Unified does?
No, in the absence of a statewide mandate, you wouldn't be required to do anything. And if, for instance, San Diego won on appeal, it would be persuasive authority, but not precedential authority. So it doesn't necessarily mean that LAUSD, for instance, which we'll talk about in a second, could in and of itself issue a similar vaccine policy. It would be done on a district by district basis.
Does that mean district by district, somebody would have to take them to court?
Yeah, I mean, the appellate court could give a broad decision indicating that the LEAs in the state of California have the right to be able to implement health and safety standards for school-wide attendance at classrooms on their campuses. So it's a slightly different mandate than the thou shalt seek a vaccine to even enroll in our schools. This is thou shalt have a vaccine to be able to attend in classroom attendance. And so as you'll see in the next case and in the charter school case, at least in the charter school's case, the LA Superior Court has already ruled in our favor. So it's likely that we will see, and there's an appeal there too, it's likely we'll see two appellate decisions in the next year, one for school district, one for charter school.
When you say our favor, whose favor?
Charter school's favor, giving charter schools the legal right to, should they so choose, to impose a vaccine mandate as a condition precedent to a child coming to a site-based part of the program.
So, in fact, then your position as a firm is to be supporting San Diego Unified's position.
Well, we advocated on behalf of our clients in LA, Granada Hills and New West, that their vaccine mandate was lawful, and we won. We don't take a firm position per se, but we did win the trial court decision in their favor, giving them the right to continue with that mandate.
Which was on top of the 10 required, they added more.
Well, but to be clear, those requirements are conditions of enrollment, like to get into, you got to show proof of vaccine to be able to get in. Then once you're in, what the charter school said, we're not going to tell you you have to get vaccinated to enroll. You can enroll in Granada, but if you don't get vaccinated, you're going to go to iGranada, the non-classroom-based program. If you want to come to classroom-based instruction, you got to get vaccinated and show proof of vaccination.
Oh, that's different from Unified. I believe I heard one of the board members say that if you're not vaccinated, to stay home.
We have the pleadings. I don't remember it being.
Yeah, it might have been to stay home and do in-person learning.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry. In-home learning, remote learning. That's what both San Diego and LA were talking about. But LA in particular, the court found, if we go to the next slide, the court found that what they were actually doing wasn't offering the school the choice. So it was an interesting situation where you had this Children's Health Defense versus LAUSD case, and there the court ruled in favor of the district student vaccine mandate. They noted that the vaccine mandate did not require students to receive COVID-19 vaccinations. Rather, they could either receive the vaccination and go and receive in-person instruction, or they could stay home and do the remote learning option. But then in July, in a separate case on that same thing, on the same subject matter, they barred the district from implementing that mandate. because they felt like their remote study, their independent study program was not actually sufficient and wasn't offering the choice that they had alleged. So that was just an interesting one there. The next ones, Paul sort of mentioned these are the charter vaccine cases. These required, these schools required their students to adopt COVID-19 vaccine policies if they were over a certain age. The parties were challenged by the same coalition that challenged the San Diego decision, let them breathe, let them choose. But unlike what happened here is that the court in the charter school cases upheld the validity of the charter school student vaccine policies. And I think what's most important about this decision is this last bullet point here. We can see that it's a court case, it's a decision recognizing the authority of charter schools to adopt campus-wide health and safety policies that best serve their students. And so it recognizes that charter schools have this broad discretion in setting policies for their campuses and their instructional programming that makes the most sense for their students, vaccine related or not. So it's kind of the way I framed this in my head was it's an important return to that idea that charter schools were born out of in the first place, right? This increased flexibility.
And with that side note on this case it represents, I think, the third or fourth time in the state of California where a court has determined that a charter school is not a state actor, as Kayla said, for purposes of constitutional proscriptions and prescriptions, which means that we are not held to the same due process requirements, free speech, some of the constitutional limitations we were talking about earlier. This is not an unusual decision. The Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals decision in Cavanaugh in Arizona about 4 or 5 years ago found that charter schools in Arizona, unfortunate comparison, operate similar to the state private prison system under contract with the state to provide a service, and therefore its employees, the guards, are not law enforcement and therefore not subject to Section 1983 civil rights lawsuits. The U.S. Supreme Court is very likely to take up a case next term brought by a North Carolina charter school claiming they have the right to enforce certain dress code standards that a lower court found violated equal protection laws. And the argument there is that the charter school is, I will say, private. I'll use the term private as opposed to state actor, and therefore not subject to the state's constitutional prohibitions and prescriptions. So it's going to be an interesting next year and a half from a legal perspective, further defining this world in which charter schools operate. And so stay tuned. We will certainly keep you up to date on all that. Just jumping into some of the statutory provisions that have occurred in the last couple of years, all for-profit charter school operations were banned. The law was not terribly well written in trying to ban charter schools being operated or owned by for-profits. And if you have an overly controlling contract with a for-profit, which you do not, as far as I know, you risk being found to be controlled by a nonprofit. In one case in Northern California in last year, a charter school that was non-classroom based was denied renewal because they found that it was more or less controlled and operated for the benefit of a for-profit corporation. Not something, again, to be worried about here, but the takeaway is to watch those overly controlling contracts with for-profit operators. There have been an uptick in audit findings against charter schools over the last, say, 4 years, ticky-tacky sometimes, compliance issues. You guys do an excellent job. I think all your audits have been without exception. But in this case, for a non-classroom-based school that had spent the money the way the restricted fund required, which was the Common Core funds, but didn't book it correctly the first year, they had to go back and redo their books. The state came in and said, you can't do that, even though technically you can. And they tried to take back $2 million. We filed a lawsuit after the Education Audit Appeals Panel ruled against the school and the trial court overturned those findings. The takeaway here is we're seeing that schools are having to fight more sometimes in court, unfortunately, to get that which they are entitled to and keep that which they are entitled to under the law, because some of the state systems, unfortunately, are kind of set up to default in a different way. And then there was a lot of federal money, as you know, that came in over the last couple of years, all these different acronyms, CARES, ESSER-1, ESSER-2, et cetera, a lot of federal money. And we're going to see all these are subject to federal audit. So we're going to see federal audits happening, I'm sure, soon in looking at the expenditures of these programs. So just a word to all, and I know Lynn and team take a very good job of all, you know, keeping compliance on all those funds, but we're going to see those compliance, I know, audits coming.
There is, if I, again, could say just a word. There are some regulations and laws, funding practices that are not coherent. And, for example, SB 740, which non-classroom-based schools have to get approved of every so often, 3 or 4 years, in order to get full funding. If there isn't a formula met between instruction and personnel and the rest of your expenditures, then you could get your funding cut to 70. There's also a requirement there that there be a ratio of a student to teacher of 1 to 25. With the shortage of teachers in California, that's going to progressively become more and more of a problem as class sizes may gradually creep up due to the fact that there's a shortage of teachers. So I don't know. I don't think you call it lobbying, but we sent a letter to that effect to the Charter Advisory Council, and we will be having one of our representatives speaking to the council to request that they realize that there's this lack of coherence and that for the next, say, 3 years, that we waive that. So that now we're not in that situation, but you never know ahead of time what, you know, the bottom could fall out. There could be problems. We have additional credentialed teachers in many, most of the classrooms. So we're okay. But that's another example of a complete left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And that creates major issues.
Yeah,
not just for private schools, I'm sure for other schools too.
But certainly more the compliance issues, which are the next couple of slides here for independent study or non-classroom based schools, are even higher. And the way that they audit, the way auditors audit non-classroom based schools, one failure on the next 6 points that we're talking about leads to loss of funding for every student impacted. So you have to have a board policy for independent study before claiming ADA through independent study. You have to have an independent study agreement in place and signed prior to commencing instruction. Again, these seem like easy tasks, but when you're, you know, when you're moving and you're seeing as many kids as your program does and as many other non-classroom-based schools, some of these details sometimes get missed. You have to provide certain levels of synchronous instruction daily and weekly for certain student types. And you're responsible for tiered levels of re-engagement for kiddos who are not showing up on a regular basis. And as Mary was saying, your certificated teachers have to maintain a ratio of less than 25 to 1, but they're also responsible for maintaining records of daily engagement, time value of work, et cetera. And all that record keeping for non-classroom-based schools is extensive, but all needed to justify the ADA and apportionments. And if, as Mary said here on number 8, non-classroom-based schools have to go through this funding determination process and have to constantly be managing these ratios of instructional materials and supplies, along with compensation for teachers, to maintain the ratios to maximize funding for their programs at preferably 100% and not 70%. And then just the last slide, you're doing obviously insurance. There is and still maintains a great deal of discussion around making sure you've got proper levels of insurance. You've got, you've got coverage for the types of new risks that were emerging. Unfortunately, a lot of the carriers came out and said, doesn't matter. We're not covering COVID-related injuries to a large extent. We're going to see some pushback, I think, in those areas coming forward in the law. And timing-wise, I think we hit 2 hours. I hope we didn't go too far past. Oh, good. We're right before 3 o'clock, which is good. And we're happy to answer any questions. Appreciate your attendance in part 2. Each of you will receive a certificate of completion for the training. I do commend you all because this was been fairly comprehensive, not fairly, very comprehensive training over part one and part two to cover all these things. And most charter schools forego professional development for their staff and for their board. And if they do anything, they might do the Brown Act. But you've done everything from fiduciary duties to conflicts to the Brown Act to trends in law, et cetera. So again, that's, I know it's a lot to take in, but it's all good information to have in the roles that you serve for the organization. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Paul. We appreciate the two of you for your excellent presentation. This is a good time to ask any questions that you might have, whether it's for staff or our attorneys, or any thoughts you might want to share. This is a good time.
I was just wondering if the recent Supreme Court decisions for reinstatement of federal employees on the that were terminated or let go for COVID related, does that affect down to this level?
You know, the employment and labor law team is working mostly in those areas, and I'm not as familiar with them, board member, but I know that they haven't mentioned anything specifically about that. But we are also litigating in California four or five cases for termination of employees who refuse to become vaccinated for school. So I think we're going to see our own case law in the state of California, if that's specifically what you're referring to.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to add too that we, of course, we're never politically active ever, but there are historically, our schools have always participated in any way we could in terms of the shaping of charter law and its implementation in California. One of the issues, again, that is strange is that we're it's referred to as a non-classroom-based school currently, and yet we have to have contemporaneous logs signed, and that doesn't, you know, the design, that those two things don't jive at all. And there is something that could solve that, and that would be if we moved, and you might have read about it, to funding based on enrollment. Funding based on enrollment would do several things. One, it would simplify the process of funding. Two, I believe it would create more equity. So if we could be based on enrollment, then any discussion on this, the mode of delivery or the type of school you have would become moot. So we certainly are encouraging a dialogue in regard to that. We've always sort of been proud of the way we were funded because we were funded based on demonstration of mastery of learning. And that's very, very good. Ideally, if we could do that, that would be wonderful. However, I don't think we can do that across the board, not for all schools, not everywhere. I just don't think that would be a huge, huge paradigm shift. And that would be years off. But I think if we could make that one step of considering that people pay taxes to support their child's instruction, therefore, they should all be eligible for the same funding, no matter what alternative you choose. And so anyway, we are promoting that. We are bringing that up and trying to create some dialogue in that regard. Certainly, we didn't think of it. I guess it came from the legislature, and the governor might even be considering the funding based on enrollment. So just to share with the board that we think that might be a very good idea. It would certainly support our interests and maybe get rid of some of these issues where there's law passed and it relates to some kinds of schools, but not other kinds of schools.
Yeah.
Is that clear, Paul? I mean, is that...
Yeah, no, I would love to see that for your teachers. That would eliminate, I would imagine, a large part of the record keeping and obligations throughout the day and make their lives a lot easier. So then they can focus more on instruction and not on record keeping.
Any more questions?
Yeah, I had a question, Admiral. And if maybe this goes to corporate counsel and to the board, you know, given the increased scrutiny from an audit perspective, and it's only going to get worse.
Okay. Thank you very much again for all of the efforts. I'll now move on to 4.0. Do I have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So moved, Barton.
Thank you.
I have a second. Morton.
Thank you. We'll conduct a voting roll call. Myself, aye. Scott?
Aye.
Great. Thank you. David?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
You are voting. Good, everybody. Thank you very much. From a record perspective, please make sure that Eric's participation was noted as completing the quorum by time. So just, okay.
Good night, everyone.
All right, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Stay safe.
Yeah.